Ocean Avenue, where I used to sit and talk with you. Hey everyone, this week's guest is Ryan Key from Yellow Card. Known Ryan and the Yellow Card guys for forever. Originally Florida boys, and got to play with them many times over the years. And in fact, Less Than Jake was on their farewell tour in 2015 with them for a good chunk. And love these guys, love the band. And I was delighted that Ryan picked arguably their biggest hit, Ocean Avenue, to discuss today. And you know, we had a lot to talk about with this one. You know, Ocean Avenue was based on a very specific moment when the band was deciding to move to California, and I had mentioned to Ryan that this seems like a relationship song, but it's actually about leaving his hometown and family. Ryan called Yellow Card the Bridge Kings because of their tendency to make long bridges in their songs. Ryan says that Ocean Avenue was 80% of the way to being left off the album because he couldn't finish the chorus. And that's just shocking to me. This seems like a theme that's kind of been running here lately. The biggest hit on the record almost left off. It's amazing to think about that. And how the chorus came like lightning in a bottle. Right away, Ryan knew it was the right chorus for the song. The band knew that Ocean Avenue was a special song the minute they recorded it. And we talked about in Ocean Avenue, the verse is as known as the chorus. There's a place off Ocean Avenue. You only get the phrase Ocean Avenue in the verse, never in the chorus, which is interesting. Ryan is grateful that the song Ocean Avenue allows him to still have a career, a job today. And Ryan proudly says the song was a team effort, even if not all the people who were involved in it still get along today. So all this and much more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
I'm always stoked when I don't have to beg for the band's or the artist's biggest song. Because, you know, a lot of times guys are like, I don't want to talk about that song. Or, you know, a lot of times a band's biggest song, or their most well-known song, I should say, is something that's a point of contention. There's a lot of things that go on with a popular song, and not all of them are good things, as you know. And sometimes it brings up bad memories, etc. But in this case, I asked Ryan, and just he wrote a text back to me. It was great. He just says, "Well, I suppose we should go with Ocean Avenue." And I'm like, "That's awesome, cool. I don't have to argue with him about this."
Well, you know, I have a podcast myself, and I understand the culture of wanting people to actually listen to your podcast. So I thought, you know, let's just use what works.
Let's go for the jugular. Well, I appreciate it, my friend. Man, this song, you know, I was telling my producer Chris before we started rolling earlier that you know, you guys got signed at Capitol by Louis, who was our product manager when we were at Capitol Records than Jake.
Louis Bandak, man.
Yep, Louis Bandak. And he's such a champion of the bands that he gets behind. He loved Less Than Jake. And, you know, I remember Louis would still come to see us play even when we were off of Capitol. Every time we'd be out in LA, he'd come out and see us.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying, "Hey, I signed this band called Yellow Card." And of course, we knew who you guys were. We had, you know, you guys from Jacksonville, Florida, and right up the road from Gainesville from us. And you know, you guys went and you know, did this record. And I know the record prior to this was on Lobster Records, One for the Kids. And yep. That was, I believe, your first full length with the band.
It was, yeah. I knew the right guys from high school, but it was not in the band in high school. So gotcha. It was just kind of buds hanging out, you know. I was in college at Florida State at the time. I tried college a couple times, didn't really ever work out for me, but it was kind of just a weekend hang that led to me playing guitar originally, and then being asked to move up to kind of being the lead vocalist guy in the band. And before One for the Kids, it's funny, I was like, because we were just a local band in Jacksonville at the time, you know, and the original formation, the original version of Yellow Card was pretty hard punk. I mean, it was more Good Riddance, old Lagwagon, you know, early mid 90s kind of sound. And here comes me with my, you know, zero rasp in voice saves the day wannabe pop songs that I'm writing, you know, and I'm like, and I'm like, we should change the name of the band because everyone here is like, they're gonna hate it, they're gonna hate, you know, and they're no, it's good, it's good. And we were basically run out of our hometown by people that, you know what I mean? So yeah, but well, yeah, One for the Kids was the first record right. that I was a part of all the songs, and we wrote a whole record together.
And you guys were playing a bunch then, and of course, you know, you relocated to LA, and now, do you recall, was the record cycle and the touring cycle for One for the Kids over with, and you're in between, now you're writing for what became Ocean Avenue? Do you remember, can you set up the song, where you were and when you wrote it?
Yeah, so we moved to California. I stayed in California after we recorded One for the Kids. We left Florida to go out there in October, I think, of 2000. And I stayed out there because I had some friends from a story that I could tell on this podcast some other time about my first journey to California when I was 19. I still had some friends there. So I just kind of couch surfed in Central California, Camarillo, Ventura area for a while until the rest of the guys came out. And that's when we started touring and playing a bunch of shows for One for the Kids. But it was fast, man. It all happened fast. We released One for the Kids, I think, in, you know, early 2001. Probably it was like February or March of 2001. And we signed our deal memo with Capitol in April of 2002. So it was quick. And we did an EP that Capitol licensed to Fueled by Ramen to make it look like we were still on an indie label, and we didn't just jump to a major.
Yeah.
It was all marketing ploy. That was great though. And having a release on Fueled by is always, you know, an honor. It's just such a cool thing to know that we were a part of that family in some way. But we started writing for Ocean Avenue in late fall, of 2002. And, we went up to this cabin that the original guitar player in Yellow Card had a family cabin up at Lake Arrowhead, like Big Bear area. And
oh, cool.
So we all went up there and just, you know, sat around being 22-year-olds drinking and smoking weed and writing songs, you know. And that was we got like the initial core of the songs up there over about a 2 or 3 week period, and then we had scheduled to go back down to LA and start pre-production at the Swing House with Neil Avron, who ended up becoming, you know, our lifelong producer after yeah. Ocean Avenue. So he was going to come in and start helping us work on the songs, and this was a process we had never done before. You know, this was crazy. I would say that record was when we learned that a great song goes verse, chorus, bridge, chorus. I had no idea. All of my old songs went verse, chorus, verse, weird second verse post thing, and then second chorus, and that was the end of the song. And it was like every song I wrote went like that for some reason. But anyways, so we were working with Neil, and it started in that, you know, it was spring of I guess I'm trying to think of the timeline, man, my old whiskey soaked brain. It was early 03 that we were working on this, and it was that riff. It started, you know, we would go in there every day, and it was back in the day when everybody would set up in a live room and play me. I mean, you guys may still do it that way, but we ended up transitioning to kind of demoing more via laptop and computer and stuff later yeah. on in our career. But back then that wasn't an option. So we were demoing to ADAT at Swing House, you know?
Yeah.
And so it started with that riff. It just started with the dun, 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 dun. It started with that rhythm on the guitar that I was playing. And at the same time, I remember I had the lyrics. There's a place off Ocean Avenue where I used to sit and talk with you in a note in my like little journal that I used to keep to write lyrics. And those two ideas kind of melded together with that riff. And that was the song.
Right.
At least that was the beginning of the song. So I'll wait till you ask me some more questions, I think, before I tell you how it went in the studio.
Well, there is a couple questions. So, you know, of course, like I said, Jacksonville is like the sister city to Gainesville. It's right next door to where my band is from. And, you know, I have an ex that was from Jacksonville. So I spent a lot of time there over the years. And I even went and researched today when I was putting notes together on the song. Now, Ocean Avenue, of course, there's, you know, A1A Boulevard, and that's sometimes mm-hmm. referred to as Ocean Avenue. But there's an Ocean Ocean Boulevard in Atlantic Beach.
That's the one.
Okay, so I'm assuming you'd named it Ocean Avenue because that sings better than Boulevard.
It rhymes better. That's absolutely the reason. Okay. It is not Ocean Avenue on the map.
There's a place off Ocean Boulevard. Okay, that doesn't work.
There's a place off Ocean Boulevard. Rhyming with that word is kinda hard. Went ahead, changed it up to Avenue. Now we have a hit to share with you. To share with you.
Exactly. And you know, the thing about that too is I had no idea when I was writing it how beneficial it was going to be that there's an Ocean Avenue in California and New Jersey and everywhere else, because in these way bigger cities and areas, you know, people were like, oh, that's my street, man. You know, so
right.
It worked out.
Just a little aside here. I actually went and watched the video this morning. I hadn't seen it in years. And I'm watching you run down the street in the video. I'm like, wait a second. That's not Jacksonville. That looks like Hollywood. I recognize that.
Yeah, that's the same Sixth Street Bridge music video shooting location that was used in every mid-2000s music video.
That's awesome. So now, again, let's go back. So you're writing songs. And do you remember... In particular, you said it started with that riff. Was this composition solely based on something you wrote? Did you write all the music and all the lyrics, or was it a band contribution at some point?
We really wrote stuff as a team. A lot of times, those kind of main riffs and stuff at that phase would come from me. I mean, at the very beginning, backtrack a little to the one for the kids thing. That would, a lot of times I would come in with a whole song idea and then we would transform it as a band. Ocean Avenue as an album as a whole was more collective. Like I said, we were writing up at the cabin and really working on the songs all together from the ground up. But this, you know, I can't remember exactly. I remember writing the chuggy guitar riff. Yeah. And we had never had a song like that was just the same three chords over and over again. And I remember in those days knowing so many of those songs, you know, whether it was Blink songs or Green Day songs or some songs that did that, or even classic old, you know, one like pops in my head, like a U2 song where they just, you know, it's just the same, what's the song I'm thinking of? With or without you, it's just the same progression over and over and over again, you know. And I always struggled with making that cool, making it work as a song. I'd be like, well, this is just super repetitive, and I can't make each part sound interesting. And never really wrote a song like that. So the bridge of Ocean Avenue obviously is a different progression, and I guarantee you that part was definitely fully band involved. I'm sure that Pete Mosley, our bass player at the time, and Sean Mackin, the violin player, that was the part where they would come in with. You know, they had more of kind of a musical theory knowledge than I did. I was kind of this raw, just like, I remember I would write stuff on guitar and our guitar player, Ben, would be like, dude, I can't play that. I don't know how to play that. You know, because I didn't take lessons or anything. And I didn't, he's like a classically trained guitarist. So something like that where the chords got, it opened up to the major one chord on the bridge. And that's the first time you hear it in the whole song. I think that's why it's so effective. That was probably a really collective effort there.
Yeah, well, you took the words out of my mouth. That's something I definitely have it circled here. I want to talk about, and we'll get there in a second, because the bridge is actually one of my favorite parts of this song.
Yeah, cool.
You know, so we, you know, this song structure has got a first verse, and you know, there's really not what you'd call a pre-chorus. I guess if you were, you'd say it'd be the sleeping all day, staying up all night.
Yeah, it's like a tag kind of.
It's like a tag. It's so I just consider that the first verse, and then there's a fake out. Doesn't go anywhere. It comes back to a second verse. You're not to the chorus yet. Yep. I notice there's a place in the corner of Cherry Street, and I actually went and I'm like, where the hell is Cherry Street? It looks like it's from Five Points, right? Is that the area?
No, there's a Cherry Street in Neptune Beach, and that lyric and all the lyrics in this song were based on a really specific moment, which was kind of right before we left for California as a band. And I had done it, as I said, I had gone to California already once before. I dropped out of college twice to try the band thing. I'm like, I'm an overachiever. So my parents had moved. This is kind of funny. Jacksonville, you know, has beaches, like beautiful beaches, but I grew up my whole life in town, like on the south side of town, in very suburban cul-de-sac neighborhood kind of vibe. And when I left at 19 to go out to California, of course, all of a sudden my parents decide they're going to move to the beach, like for the first time in our life. And so I leave, they move to the beach. My sister gets to go to high school and live her whole teenage years at the beach. And
thanks, mom and dad.
Yeah, for sure. So I come back and they were house shopping at the beach and had this rental that was kind of like a three-story guest apartment thing that somebody was renting out on the back of their house. And it was literally on across First Street from the beach. So it was a killer spot. But that's where I was kind of staying when I first came back from school or from California the first time and was playing in Yellow Card. And so when we were leaving that whole area, just that Neptune Beach, Florida area with Cherry Street and what became Ocean Avenue, that's actually Ocean Boulevard, our guitar player was renting a house on Ocean and a bunch of people lived there. And so we would hang out and party over there all the time and write music there and stuff. So it was just this collective kind of area where it was like the song was kind of saying goodbye to this specific moment in time, which also at the same time, while it was a very specific moment in time, felt very permanent. It also felt like this is going to be way more than a specific moment in time. Like I feel like this is the end. I'm not going back this time, you know?
Right, right.
I say that now, by the way, as I'm officially living back in Jacksonville for the first time in 21 years, and I think I'm not leaving here ever again now. I'm pretty settled, but still, at the time, it felt like that was the move.
Gotcha. So now you said this, you know, at least the first verse, you know, that was something that was just sitting in a journal. So was this song, was it about something in your life, or was it just like a story that you wrote?
Was it
autobiographical?
I think I had this clever thing that I didn't do on purpose a lot in Yellow Card, where I would write songs about something that would translate in people's minds to a relationship song, which, as you know, they do well with, you know, young people and that youthful fan base that came up in the Warped Tour and with bands like Yellow Card. So this song wasn't really about one person specifically at all. It was kind of inspired by a night that I had where I was saying, I have a family here in Jacksonville that's three brothers and a sister that I was really, really close with growing up. And spent, you know, all my days and nights with them. And there was just a kind of a specific night where we all said goodbye to each other. They were like, we were all hanging out literally the night before we all, Yellow Card, got in the van to drive out to record one for the kids. And I just remembered that night very vividly. And I kind of just wrote about that, the feelings of that. But the song, if you look at it, you know, from a certain point of view, it's like a breakup song or a, you know, leaving someone you love.
Right, but it doesn't even necessarily need, it could be leaving a friend that you love.
Sure.
You know,
but I think a lot of my songs, I think a lot of my songs came across that way about like sounding or feeling like they were about a very specific person when really at times they were more, I think I was translating like bigger moments and scenes into songs that sounded more specific. So I think the subject matter of Ocean Avenue was actually pretty broad, but the yous in the song, you know, the person I'm speaking to in the song makes it feel more specific.
And then, you know, in the first verse we got, there's a place off Ocean Avenue where I used to sit and talk with you. We were both 16 and it felt so right. And then there's the sleeping all day part. And then the second verse that happens, right afterwards, it doesn't go to the chorus yet. There's a place on the corner of Cherry Street. We would walk on the beach in our bare feet. We were both 18 and it felt so right. Was that a conscious jump those 2 years? What happened to 17?
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that was the gap between,
I think, it and drank it away.
Yeah. You know, it's funny actually that you're asking me that. And I don't know why in the second one I didn't. It was probably the same thing where it just kind of rolled off the tongue better, sang better, as we say, to say 18 instead of 19. But that was still the gap. Was in at 16, was high school, and my friends that I just mentioned, that I think a lot of this song was rooted in, that night saying goodbye to them. We would spend a lot of time at the beach. They lived closer to the beach than me, so I would drive out there a lot when I was a kid at 16, and we would just go out there at night and drink beers and smoke weed and be, you know, rambunctious high schoolers as we were. And then I came back to Florida at 19, after I went to California, and that's when I was staying with my parents out on Cherry Street. So it was kind of that was kind of a jump. There was a gap in time.
Yeah, you know, what I always loved about this song, and geez, we did one of the last Yellow Card tours when we were over in Europe with you guys, and it was like within the last year of you guys being a band. And I love, no matter how many times I saw you guys play this song, I just love the audience reaction, because the minute you'd started, of course, and what I always loved about this song was it goes through the two verses and it's got the chug, you know, chug-a-lug thing with the guitars, and it's kind of in its own world. And it's like kind of doing the same thing for 35, 40 seconds. And I mean, literally out of nowhere, boom, that chorus hits. If I could find you now, it just lifts. The whole song just goes from zero to six. Not zero. I mean, the song's going along.
It
goes boom. It goes like 100 miles an hour. Do you recall that? Like, did anything change from the beginning of writing the song to that, or and what did Neil bring to that chord? Did you ever talk about we need the chorus to lift here, or was that just kind of how the song was written?
I wish I could remember exactly the evolution from the chug to the chords. I know that there was a conscious decision of wanting the song to just be the same three chords and kind of having that be a challenge. You know, can we pull this off? Can we write a song like With or Without You, that was just the same three chords over and over again, but we make each section build and lift and stay interesting. I will say that I remember at the Swing House, I was thinking about this before we got on today. I was trying desperately to remember the melody, and I bet if I called Pete, our bass player at the time, he would remember, because I think he was the one who was like, no, dude, you can't use that. But we had the three chord chorus thing going, and it was big, you know, like you said, that definitely came to be in the practice room, like in the rehearsal space. We developed the song to open up into that chorus. I mean, we were able to play it all the way through before we went into the studio. So, but I had this melody for the chorus, and it was some like female pop artist, massive hit song from the 80s, like mid or early 80s even. And it was like a melody that I had, and everyone was like, dude, no, you can't use that. It's this. And it was like a Cyndi Lauper song, or it was something like that.
As long as no one knows, fuck it.
Someone would have known, dude. I'm glad someone caught it, because we probably would have gotten in trouble. But I just remember it being perfect in my mind. And so I was so frustrated. And I'll, when we get into the recording, I'll tell you a great, I'll add on to that story and tell you a great thing.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, like I said, just, I just would love, you know, the minute you'd start the song live and the audience goes crazy, but when the chorus hits, it's like the place goes, now the party's on, it goes ballistic. Yep. It's just great. You break down to the second verse here, and, you know, it's pretty much the same as the first two verses. And then you hit that chorus again. And then out of nowhere, like you said, now it resolves with this bridge, and it's this big breath of fresh air. And I love the production on the bridge, that little arpeggiated clean guitar that comes in there picking. It's just, it's so good. And, I liked also how the bridge just doesn't go through one time. It's a pretty long bridge, but it works.
Yeah, we did that a lot. We were the bridge kings.
Yeah, no, but it works. Sometimes it gets, you know, I use the word laborious. It just gets like, it's too much, but this is perfect. Again, do you remember it all, like, and I know I've asked about him a couple of times, but just wondering what Neil brought to this, because
he's
such a fantastic pop punk producer.
Yep. He brought a lot to that, if I recall. I mean, think about how it opens up on the major one, which is the A major chord, and it does that kind of flam, you know, on the drums, and the bass is going from, I guess it's going from what would it be? Is it going from A flat to, I kind of want to grab a guitar and find out, or is it going from...
And I wish I did. I usually pick up
the guitar. I think it's going, I think the bass is going like A flat to A, while the guitar, you know, it's going, and we're just playing the A. And then and it's keeping the guitars are keeping the rhythm from the verse. It's going, they're going bum 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 na na na, but they're just hanging on the A, and then it drops into a straight beat like the chorus, but it just stays on the A, you know. And I don't think we would have thought of things like that. And Neil was definitely involved in like, let's do this little teaser of the A chord, and then we'll just jump in on the same chord. And I think without him, things like that, we would have been like, well, you can't play the same chord, you can't start a section and then start it again on the same chord, things like that, you know. And
yeah, and all the tones there change too, the guitar,
yeah, for sure, change. it gets real sparkly
yeah, it gets sparkly, but it like I mentioned before, it's just this big breath of fresh air that by the end of it, you know, and like I said, it's a pretty long bridge that totally works, but by the end of it you're like, I know what's coming. That damn chorus is coming again.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
it just belts you in the head again. And it's great. Yeah. Did you guys, you'd mentioned recording on ADATS at, what was the studio called again? Something Farm?
The Swing House.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's like a legendary, you know, rehearsal. They have a full studio there too, but it's mostly for rehearsal, kind of like SIR style.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I've never been to the Swing House. I've did a bunch of work at SIR.
Some crazy stories of people that we were there with. Like Soundgarden there was just the Chili Peppers were there one time. We made a couple of records there, like rehearsed for a couple of records there, and it was like some of our most LA Hollywood mind-blowing, like, yeah, it's Chris Cornell's just
you
pulled
guys
up.
You guys got to see current stars, like we had Quiet Riot at Sir with us.
we were definitely seeing people that were still very like current legend.
So do you recall actually demoing the song? Does a demo exist of Ocean Avenue before you did it with Neil?
I would have to ask if Neil has those tapes, you know. But no, we didn't have any kind of setup back in those days to demo pre-production.
So we
just didn't. We would just rehearse them 1,000 times to be ready. And I remember we were up in Arrowhead working on the songs, you know, we knew that we were going to go work with Neil, and we were so nervous about being prepared. So, I mean, we were drilling these songs, and we probably had like 6 or 7 of the 13 songs done up there, you know, as far as done on our end before Neil got a hold of them and was like, this part sucks, this part's awesome, do this part 4 more times, you know? And we had never really been produced that way. But we just didn't have the recordings like that. And I know somewhere there's some ADAT tapes with those Swing House recordings, and I'm sure they sound real good. Not
well. Now, so do you remember how long before you actually met up with Neil? And I'm assuming you did some kind of pre-production with Neil before you press record. You were going over the material.
He was there for the whole time we were at Swing House.
Gotcha.
We started there with him for a full. Let's tell everybody about 2003. Unknown band, major label recordings, just to really put it in perspective compared to now. We had a $350,000 recording budget initially. It almost doubled by the end, but they gave us that. And the amount of time we had to make this record was a month up in the mountains on our own, and then a full month in Swing House, 4 whole weeks of rehearsal with Neil, and then 5 weeks at Sunset Sound in the studio with Neil.
Yeah.
With a food budget, by the way. You got three meals a day.
Labels were wiping their ass with $100 bills back then. I mean, it was a different world.
Crazy. So we had a whole month of pre-production with Neil at SIR. And I, you know what though? I swear that month changed my life forever. That's when I learned how to become a songwriter, was in those 4 weeks, my first time working with Neil Avron. It changed me forever.
And was there any reason, you know, I know Newfound had done the record with Neil by then. I believe Stahedon Sticks and Stones. Was this a label's call, or was Neil like your dream producer choice?
This is so funny. Eric Valentine was our dream producer choice. Well, really? I don't know if I can speak for everyone. It was my dream producer choice.
Which Eric Valentine's amazing. He's great
too.
Yes.
So the way I understand the story, and some of this could be wrong. You know, we're not the young men we once were, and your memory just remembers things the way it wants to sometimes. But this is the way I remember it. We were playing at the Avalon I don't think it was called the Avalon back then. But either way, something like that. In Hollywood, and we were opening for No Use for a Name, And Eric Valentine was coming. We had had a meeting at Capitol, basically, where we said, you know, where they said, who are your dream producers? And we went with all these 90s, you know, Brendan O'Brien and Eric Valentine and all these people like that. So thinking like, there's no fucking way we're going to get to work with these guys. But Eric Valentine was coming to the show at the Avalon. And this is how I understand it. And if someone wants to at me and tell me, you know, at the label, if anyone sees this, although everyone at the label is like 60 now, but from then, but still, he came to this show and apparently wasn't on the list. And he was like, well, fuck you then. And left. And that was it. Yep. And that was it. No Eric Valentine.
Which, you know, but, what's crazy with fate in this business, you know, as well as I do, there's a chance that Eric Valentine could have produced this record and it wouldn't have done anything for you guys. You never know.
I think about it all the time. And the way we met Neil was so cool, man. He had one for the kids and that record to me, I don't want to upset anyone who loves it as well. And I know it is what it is and what it stands for the band, but just the production and it's so old and it's actually hard for me to listen to. It's kind of like Nails on a Chalkboard style.
I can relate.
Okay, good, good. I'm glad you understand what I mean. Yeah. But he thought there was something there to the record, Neil did, you know? And so we were playing, at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco. God, was that show with you guys? Because we were in an RV at the time, and we were in an RV on that tour with you that we did. I can't remember if that Bottom of the Hill show was. We definitely weren't headlining.
That might have been. Was
I can't remember.
Was One Man Army on that with us?
I can't remember, but I think I'm really thinking it might have been. But the point is, Neil flew up to San Francisco to come to this show because there wasn't an LA show that he could get to before like touring was done or whatever, something like that. So he flew up there, watched the show and got on the RV with us afterwards and basically just was like, I think you guys have something special and I want to be a part of it. And if you trust me to make your record, I'd love to do it. And there was just no question in our mind. We're like, dude, he came all the way up here. The Newfound Glory record sounds insane.
Well, to any great producer, they can see through the warts and the scratches of One for the Kids. You know, he could see, go, okay, there's something here that I can definitely mold this. And, which is great. And so, you're doing the record now, you're recording it. And by the way, where did you record the album at?
Sunset Sound.
Oh, you did, dude, did Sunset. Yeah.
We did Ocean Avenue and Lights and Sounds, at Sunset Sound,
which is legendary.
Sunset Sound. Dude, it's my two of my favorite and, you know, things I'm most grateful for experiences in my musical career was getting to make those albums at that studio. It's awesome. With me forever.
That's awesome. And you're there and you're tracking the record now. How many songs were on the record? 12 or 13?
13.
13. 13 songs. Where in your mind, you're in there, you know, you've got the drum tracks down, you're starting to lay guitars, maybe the bass is starting to get laid down. Where is Ocean Avenue in your mind at this point in terms of single, video, or is it just another song? Were there other songs that you felt were better than this? Where were you at with it at that point?
So this is what I was hoping you were going to ask me. Ocean Avenue was 80% close to not going on the record.
That's so crazy. I just had a conversation with someone the other day about their
I trip. Couldn't. So remember back to a few minutes ago when I told you the Cyndi Lauper story or whoever it was. I couldn't finish the chorus, dude. I couldn't do it. I remember walking into the control room with 15 different ideas and Neil just being like, meh, keep trying. And I couldn't get it, dude. It was something about the three chords repeating. I couldn't come up with something that was interesting or like made people go, well, you know, yes, that hits where it should as a chorus.
Did you have these lyrics though? Were they the same Cyndi Lauper melody? So these came when it was finally this chorus.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. But we all knew the verse though. The verse was recorded. We had gotten to a point where it was like, let's track the verses. And I don't remember if I tracked the bridge or not, but it was something like that where it was like, well, we have this meat of it. Let's track it and maybe it will help you if you have a nice recording of it to kind of live with and sing along to. And so that's what I would do while everybody else was working on stuff that we had. There was a little, like the vocal room at, I think we were in studio 3 at Sunset Sound. It's the big one. It's a big room. So there's this big vocal room with a couch in it and stuff. And I could kind of close myself off in there and work, I remember. And, I would just sit in there with it and sing it over and over again. I couldn't get anything.
So Ocean Avenue didn't make the record. Were you still going to call the album Ocean Avenue?
No. I don't think that was in anybody's mind at all until this song was done. And it does tie into your question about like, where was it single wise and all that stuff, because the way I remember it is they were tracking something else, a lead guitar, or Sean was in the big live room tracking violin for something. He was probably pissed at me because I walked in with another idea, you know, and I just kind of walked into the booth or to the control room, excuse me, and said, "Hey, can you pull up Ocean Avenue? Let me sing this one for you." And I was like, "Hey, you know, Sean, hold on a sec. We're gonna do a thing real quick." And he pulls it up, and I just, "If I could find you now, things would get better. We could leave." And he was like, "That's it. Go record it right now." So it was like whoever was working at the time was like, "You're done for the day. We're recording this vocal."
And what finally happened with that lightning in the bottle? Do you remember? Like how did that
I go? Don't.
Right.
I don't. I mean, I know.
You don't remember. So I'm thinking like, how the hell did this, because it sounds like you did a rewrite on this thing like a dozen times.
I did. So I'm sure it was, I was sitting there in that vocal room on my own, and I knew this one. I do kind of remember knowing, oh, okay, this works. Like this is cool. And walking in there to sing it to Neil, and his reaction was very clear. It was like, yes, that's it. Let's do it.
I love the lyric, you know, and I love the lyric for so many reasons, because everyone can relate. I mean, Bruce Springsteen's made a career about leaving this town. You know, Neil Young, all the great songwriters, that imagery of leaving this town and starting over. Less Than Jake, History of a Boring Town. Most of our early records mention about leaving town and starting over. And if I could find you now, things would get better. We could leave this town and run forever. Let your waves crash down on me and take me away. I mean, you know, we could leave this town. People love that. There's a sense of rebellion there. There's a sense of I'm starting over. F you. I'm going to do this. And people can latch on to that as much as they can latch onto a love song. And I think that, you know, that lyric combined with the melody that you came up with, it was the perfect mesh.
It was a perfect storm, as you say. Yeah. I mean, it was the actual leaving town that we had done. It was that night with my friends that was very overwhelming and sad to feel like I was saying goodbye to this chapter of my life that I knew was actually over this time. It was going to California the first time, which made this second time, I think, feel more real, knowing that I had tried and been unsuccessful, but that this time I was not going to give up, and I was really going, you know, there was all those perfect things that led to this very kind of basic and simple idea, leave this town and run forever, that I had no idea that at the time I was, you know, I'm not going to compare myself to Springsteen, but I like that you bring him. I love Bruce Springsteen, especially his, I'm a late Springsteen fan. Like I love the stuff he makes now.
That's great.
But to compare myself in some way to that leaving town concept that, you know, he got huge on, that was the thing. It was just this perfect storm of life events that led me to write this simple line of lyrics that everyone ended up relating to.
Yeah.
I knew it was good, but I had no idea that that's what I was doing at the
time.
Well,
and how many times have you been on tour with a band too? And it's like, you know, you hear their song every night. And I've heard Ocean Avenue a ton of times. Plus it was a huge radio hit, but it's a great song's a great song, man. And 17, 18 years later here, it's every time I hear it or when I see you guys play it, I would, like I said, we did that European tour together, and I'd watch it every night. I love the reaction. I just love the song. When the song was finished, you got the chorus down. Did you guys know then, like, this is great, this is special, or was it still kind of like, it's just Ocean Avenue?
No, we knew. There aren't a lot of songs, and well, I think for a while after that, especially after the success of Ocean Avenue. So some of the songs on Lights and Sounds, it was like, yeah, that's it. But after that, when it was like, okay, this doesn't happen every time that you think you've reinvented the wheel with a song. We realized in hindsight how special Ocean Avenue was, but also in the moment, we did realize we had something special. I mean, the power of it, the weight of that chorus, like you said, when it drops in, and then also to learn this like later when you look back, it's funny how this song, I genuinely think that the verse is as, you know, known as sung,
yeah,
as the chorus. I mean, when people talk about Yellow Card, they go, "There's a place off Ocean Avenue." They don't go, "If I could find you now." That's not the thing they sing.
Yeah,
right?
And that's the brilliance of that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to mention that. The song's called Ocean Avenue, and you only get that in the verse.
Right.
The one time. You don't get it,
yep.
You know, which is amazing. Linkin Park made a career out of that. You didn't know if the chorus was the verse or the verse was the chorus. They were
exactly, man.
They were geniuses at that, you know.
And live, like you said, watching it live, that whole concept is just mind-blowing, because it's the only song, I think, really, in our entire catalog of songs where every word to both verses, chorus, bridge, it's really everyone is singing every word.
Yeah,
you know, awesome. There's other songs that have huge choruses that are Yellow Card songs that I love and I'm really proud of, and people sing the shit out of them, but they'll mix, you know, you can see people mixing up the words or doing the kind of mouthing like meh, in the verse, you know, nobody cares about the verse. It's that whole thing.
Yeah, sure.
Like, why do we even write verses? Who cares? You know, but this one, it was like the verse was a chorus too. And the bridge was a chorus too. It just, I don't know, man. It's, you know, it's, I say it all the time. This song is the reason I still have a job. So whenever
And you know what? That's really cool of you to say, because, man, you know what? Some people don't get the one song that still gives them the job. You know, they never get that song, or they never get that break, or whatever you want to call it. And the fact that you could be grateful for this song, because like I said at the top of the podcast, it's like sometimes people are begrudgingly, they don't want to talk about that song. Maybe an ex-bass player or a guitar player had a hand in, you know, there's bad memories attached to it, but you're grateful for this, and that's awesome.
Well, I think it's cool that you say that too, because it's not a secret that Yellow Card and members that have been and still are or were, you know, haven't always ended on the best terms or remained through life on the best terms. But that said, I will proudly say that this was a team effort. You know, I didn't write this. I didn't walk in the door and say, as we've talked about now on the podcast, I didn't walk in the door and go, "Hey guys, I've got our hit song." You know, I couldn't have been a part of this song without the other guys that were a part of it.
Yeah. And I've always maintained that with myself too. It, you know, it's a band a lot of times is definitely the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
One last thing I just want to touch on. So what was that like? The record comes out and all of a sudden this song goes to radio. You're 22 years old and this thing just goes through the roof. And just to get my listeners a little comparison here, and this is by no means being disparaging towards Less Than Jake. We've had a storied, amazing career, but we never had a radio hit. You know, on the one song that wasn't even pushed to radio, it's a song called Rest of My Life that was on our record. It came out in 2005, and that song has garnished over 5 million YouTube views, which is nothing to sneeze at. But Ocean Avenue has 40 million YouTube views. I mean, it was a massive hit. And what was that like? What did that feel like? Because I mean, we've had a great success, but it was always kind of the slow climb with us. It never just went like, holy shit, boom.
Yeah. Man, I feel like we need to do a second podcast to answer that question.
Give us the condensed version. I mean, that had to just be amazing.
It was absolutely surreal. We were by all definition a garage band. When we started, we literally practiced in parents' garages, you know, so it was absolutely mind blowing.
And combine it with the fact that this was almost a track that was left off the record.
Exactly. And we had like a little taste before Ocean Avenue. Look, our time at Capitol Records was for all my friends in the music business that have had these horrific major label stories, which so many people do, like, you know, they were so excited and they got this big deal and they were going to be the next big thing. And then they just get lost in the shuffle and put on the shelf. We had this team at Capitol that was so passionate about our band, and it felt so grounded and not Hollywood at that time. Now we could do another podcast about just Yellow Card in general. It changed over the years, but at the beginning, it was so rooted in what we were as a band when we started, and it stayed that way even as it climbed to this, you know, stratospheric level of success. The marketing and the attitude towards the band was, well, let's keep it. You know, we were going to go with a fourth single. Empty Apartment was going to be a fourth single, and the decision was made to not do that in order to not oversaturate the band and take away from the roots of the band. And that was all Capitol's decision. You know, we were probably like, come on, no, let's do it bigger, more, you know, but that was the vibe. So we had a little taste of it with Way Away, the first single. I will never forget sitting on the bus as a band in 2003, the year that the album came out, because Ocean Avenue, the song, didn't hit. It released to radio in January, I think, of 04, but didn't really hit until that summer of 2004. But in 03, the summer before, we were on the bus, and I remember the moment watching Way Away on MTV for the first time, you know, seeing our band on MTV. And so I almost want to say that was a more impactful experience, because it was, I remember the moment so specifically.
Yeah.
And then we were kind of in the machine at that point, you know, the radio and everything.
Yeah. By the time Ocean Avenue came out, you kind of were already in the bubble. Yeah.
Right. But when we started getting the phone calls about the numbers and the chart positions and the album sales and all this stuff, we were just, I mean, we didn't, and again, like you said, we were 24 years old. We didn't know how to handle any of that stuff. I just know we thought we were the coolest kids that ever lived. You know, we were just so blown away by what we were accomplishing and couldn't understand how it was real.
And you were, man. And that's cool. And you deserve every bit of success that came along with it. And, you know, I'm proud to still call you a friend after all these years.
Dude,
I love this song. We're still out there doing it. That's testament to having a good band and good songs. So, we're going to wrap things up here. If you'd like to let our listeners know what's going on the world of William Ryan Key, please let them know.
Yeah, for sure. I'm doing a couple different things right now. One is kind of not, people don't really have access to, but I'm really excited about it. I've been working for the last many months on starting to really get my foot in the door with scoring and composing for film. It's been a big dream of mine for a long, long time. And so I'm currently working with Ryan Mendez, the lead guitar player for Yellow Card, who has been a writing partner of mine ever since Yellow Card ended. We work on a lot of stuff together, but we're scoring our first feature film right now, and we're really having a blast and
that's awesome.
Hoping it's going to open some more doors for us. But for music of my own that you can, you know, get and listen to, because I'm working so hard on the scoring stuff, I've realized that, like, releasing and doing an album cycle and touring and all that kind of stuff, it just may not be the best avenue for me.
Or Boulevard.
So, or Boulevard, if you want to get literal. So I have some friends who have started these things and are having this incredible experience connecting with fans and providing content, doing live stream sets and all this kind of stuff. And I researched it and it felt like a really great idea. So by the time this podcast comes out, it will probably have already been launched. But I have a Patreon page where I'm going to be releasing a new song every month. And doing a live show every month and a Q&A every month and doing some handwritten lyrics for, you know, downloads and stuff for people. Just a bunch of different cool things that I feel like are cool ways to engage with the people who still support me in post Yellow Card life. So I'm really excited about it and building the community and writing, recording new songs. I'm able to kind of just explore the studio space, you know, as Will Ferrell once said. And so I'm able to just kind of, like, I mean, these songs are way off the boulevard of Yellow Card. But for me, it's just, that's what keeps me making music, is really pushing boundaries and my own boundaries, I mean, and kind of exploring new sounds and stuff. So I'm sort of using this as a platform for people to maybe come along with me and listen to all the different stuff I'm trying. But it's fun and I'm loving writing the songs. So, like I said, it'll be a new song every month, and it's patreon.com/WilliamRyanKey. And then one last one, I know you got to go, but I have a podcast with two of my buddies, Adam Russell from the band Story of the Year and Nick Gambarian from the band Bayside. The three of us have a Star Wars podcast called Thank the Maker. And you can find it anywhere you get podcasts. And we are having a blast doing this. And it's really growing. It's crazy. We just had Ashley Eckstein, who is the voice of Ahsoka Tano on The Clone Wars, on as a guest.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, she's like one of the biggest people in the Star Wars universe. I'd say she's like the biggest female Star Wars star behind Daisy Ridley right now, you know. So we're making waves with that, and it's just such a fun hang. So if you're into Star Wars, or you just want to hear some band dudes be geeks, check it out. Thank the Maker is our podcast.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, Ryan, thank you for giving me your time today, and thanks for, again, for being a friend, and best of luck with everything. All right.
To be going to see Less Than Jake at the Milk Bar when I was 16 years old in Jacksonville, and then to hang out with you the way I do now, it's an honor and a pleasure, sir.
Yeah, buddy. Thank you so much, man. Much love to you, all right?
All right, bud. You too.
All right.
Be well.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be previewed on Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. Again, that's bandyoumightnotknow, all one word, @gmail.com. All I ask for is a good quality recording of a song you feel best represents your band. This week's featured band is String Machine, based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The lineup consists of David Beck on guitar and vocals, Dylan Kirsten on synth and tambourine, Nick Temple on the drums, Mike Law on bass, Ian Compton on trumpet and guitar, Laurel Wayne on vocals, and Katie Morrow on the cello. You can find them on Instagram at String Machine Music, and you can find their music on Bandcamp and all the streaming sites. Here's a clip of their song, No Holiday, Excite Again.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
All right, man. Well, there we go again. There's the recurring theme that we heard back in Tim McElrath from Rise Against episode. The song that almost got left off the album, it almost got cut or became a B-side, becomes a worldwide smash hit single.
Yeah. How many times has this happened now? Was it only the Tim episode? I could have swore it happened again. It's amazing that... This almost ended up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. I don't, what's up with that? Is it because those songs, maybe the people writing them thought of those songs as being too simple as far as like the chord progression and the arrangement, and thought like, no, I have all these other songs that are more complex. And
I think
is
it could
that
be,
part
I,
of it?
I think it could be a number of things. Yeah, I think that could be one component to it. I think other things is no one truly, they can say they do, but no one truly knows what a hit song is. Or maybe not so much what a hit song is, but what that song and how that song's going to resonate among listeners. What that song's going to make other people feel. Because as a writer, as an artist, sometimes you're just too close to the song. You're too attached to it. And sometimes you're maybe sick of it. You know, like, Tim had touched on that to where he was just like, you know, I just got to the point where I was banging my head against the wall. I just couldn't figure out how I wanted this and that to be in the song. And Ryan even mentioned that he just couldn't get a chorus.
Yeah. And hey, that was a common theme between those two songs, is both those guys couldn't get that finishing touch on that song. And then when it happened, it was like magic.
Yeah. And in relation to this song, every aspect of Ocean Avenue, it became the title of the album. It was how they marketed the record. It was the front cover of the record, the artwork, everything went along with the theme of Ocean Avenue. It became everything about the record was this song. And to think if it was left off, that none of that would have happened. And who knows if they would have been a household name.
Right. Yeah. And I thought it was wild. And we've touched on this in other episodes too, that these kind of recording budgets don't exist anymore these days. But Ryan brought up the fact that Yellow Card had a $350,000 budget, and they ended up spending twice that on the recording. And at that time, and I guess it was a big part of it, was because people still bought the physical compact discs at the time, and I think that there was more money available for that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, just the fact they recorded at Sunset Sound, which is a legendary studio. I mean, when you park your car at Sunset Sound and you open the front, the door of your car, and as soon as your foot hits the pavement, it's $1,500. Wow. just to get in the building. I mean, I don't know exactly, but I mean, it was something like that back then. I remember, you know, studios were still charging a premium to get in. The, you know, home recording capabilities in your own studios just definitely wasn't where it's at today. And labels had money. People were buying physical product. They had that money to throw around that doesn't exist today.
Are those type of studios going the way of like Blockbuster Video now?
You know, the good ones are still out there, and I'm sure that their prices have come down considerably since, I mean, this record was recorded in 2002, Ocean Avenue. So, but it's just, again, it goes to show you the money that was floating around that labels had then. Just the waste of money that was going on. I mean, we yeah. had that issue less than Jake with being on labels. We'd see how money was allocated. We're like, why are they spending all this? And the fact of the matter was, it was because they had it.
Well, also, don't you have to recoup that money when you're the band?
Well, like, you do, but you know, we probably owe Capitol and Warner Brothers a total of you know, $6 million right now. And so the beauty of the contract as a band is you sign as a band, and they'll continue to make money off those records in perpetuity. And if you pay them back, you pay them back, but they can never come after me personally for my assets, thank God.
Right. That's a good thing.
Because I'd be sitting in the middle of a dirt field right now somewhere in Sanford, Florida.
Right. Dude, I think that it's also it's always very interesting in that kind of, and you know, obviously a lot of our guests, you've talked to them about like, when's the first time you heard your song on the radio or whatever. But some of these songs that we've talked about on the podcast, Ocean Avenue, a perfect example, became like gigantic songs. And to hear the artist talk a little bit about what that was like to have this enormous song that is just like bigger than the sum of its parts. It's bigger, like the song becomes bigger than the band. The song is just like, you know, enormous. And what that feels like, it's always interesting to me. It makes me a little envious, but in a cool way.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was funny because we had done a U.S. tour with them, Yellow Card, around 2003, and the song was blowing up. I mean, and there was people, and you could tell they would watch Yellow Card, and then we would play, and after Yellow Card, there was some people leaving the show, and that wasn't, you know, a knock on Less Than Jake. It's just that just shows you how big they were getting. They were getting these periphery radio people that necessarily didn't even know who Less Than Jake was, or didn't even know who Yellow Card was three months prior, and it was just blowing up in the U.S. And then that fall, we had taken them over to the U.K. where we had a stronghold, and I remember, you know, they had a good reaction. They were starting to get a buzz over there, but it wasn't like it was in the States, you know. So
right.
it was odd going from the U.S. where, I mean, when they would play Ocean Avenue, the place would go bonkers, and then, you know, seeing them in the U.K., it hadn't hit over there yet, and it was just a short couple months later. So things happened quick for those guys, and as Ryan touched on, and he said that you know, it was absolutely surreal when the song blew up that. You know, they went from being like this garage band to having this huge hit, and they were young, for lack of a better word, kids. They were in their early 20s.
Right. Hey, I one more thing I wanted to touch on that kind of relates to songwriting, which, you know, is the theme of the podcast, is, you know, in Less Than Jake or in any song that you've written, have you ever set out like kind of intentionally trying to write a hit song? Like, I know that, yeah, every song we write, we're trying to write a hit song, but I mean, really like studied the format of like other hit songs and tried to like emulate that ever? And if you have, how did that turn out? Are there any, do you have any examples from Less Than Jake where like you kind of tried to do that?
No, not like that verbatim, and like taking a blueprint of another song and been like, I'm going to try to, you know, emulate this and make it into a cookie cutter hit for ourselves. But I did do some co-writes with other people, Mark Hoppus from Blink being one of them, and some other folks. I did some co-writes just to try to branch out and try to, you know, have other ideas come in, because I know where my instincts lie as a songwriter. I know where I'm going to go. I know what chord I'm going to go to here most of the time. And it's nice to have someone challenge you and push you.
Right. So I think, yeah.
Yeah. So that's you know, for me, that was not so much wanting to write a hit single. It was wanting to branch out and try to do different things and learn things as a writer.
Right. I think my main point was anytime, and it hasn't been a lot of times that me and my band or whatever have set out to like, let's write this hit song, that it doesn't work out. That's not the way to approach songwriting in my experience. The way to approach it is to write a song from the heart. And I think people can see through that. And if you're just trying to write to the lowest common denominator and try to sound like what's on the radio or what's popular, that the song is going to suffer. And that is not going to be the song that people latch onto. I'm sure there are exceptions to that rule. I'm sure record labels have put together and created a few hits that way. But, well,
and so much of it is right time, right place. I mean, I can't tell you how many follow-up records to the big hit, the band, or here's the next single from the record. And actually, the song is better than the hit, or in my opinion, it's better. I'm like, this is going to be a smash, and it just does nothing. It doesn't resonate. It was, it might have even been a carbon copy, kind of the same format, verse, chorus, and kind of had the same lyrical theme. But in this case, I thought the song was better, but it just... It didn't come out 2 years ago. It didn't have this attached to it. All these other factors that go into it, right time and right place. And a little bit of luck goes a long way with all this stuff. And there's no science or true formula behind it.
Yeah, there's a lot of intangibles there, man. You could write a perfect song. It's just a beautiful song, awesome lyrics, perfect arrangement. And yeah, if it's not the right time for it, if it would have hit the following year or the year before, just because of like what was going on, whether it was in music or in the world or anything like that, you can't account for those things. And all you can do, just like anyone says that luck is like when preparation meets what? I forget what that phrase is, but it's basically like being ready for an opportunity, being as prepared as possible. And that's the same way with music. If you keep writing great songs, I feel like in one way or another, you will be successful. I like to think that anyway.
Well, I can't argue with you. And I also want to thank you for your segue just now. You're talking about the perfect song, and I'd like to write somebody their perfect song. Thank you, Chris. Keep those custom songs coming. I'd love to write a custom song for you, your business, a jingle for your business, for your family, for your band, for whatever. And Chris and I are also offering animation to go along with that. To see some of our examples, you can go to chrisdemakes.com. That'll redirect you to the YouTube page where you can see our work. And for more info on all of this, you can email me, chrisdemakes@gmail.com. Please keep subscribing. Keep the word of mouth going about the podcast. If you haven't already, join the Chris DeMakes a Podcast Facebook group. It's a private group, but it's easy to join. All you have to do is submit who you'd like to see on the show. You can follow me at Instagram at @LessThanChrisD, on Twitter at @LessThanChris, and on Facebook at @OfficialChrisDeMakes. And I think that's about it. Until next week, we'll see you then.